From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for Sunday, April 17th, 2016. This is our weekly look back at the political scene of last week and your tip sheet for what lies ahead. So grab that Sunday paper, a good hot cup of coffee, and let's get this week off to a great start. And it actually, this weekend got off to a great start. We're finally getting that weather that we've been waiting for. A beautiful day in downtown Chicago on Saturday. Great weather expected today and tomorrow. All I can say is it's about time. But, Chwani, I got to tell you, with better weather comes road construction season.
Winter and road construction, yes.
And yesterday, coming into the tower to do the little bit of show prep that I do, because anybody who knows the show knows that there isn't much show prep involved.
Spontaneity is the name of the game.
Hey, right? Thank you. Thank you for that. I'll remember that.
If anyone asks.
Yes, that's a good motto. Maybe I can get that as a bumper sticker. But I'm coming down State Street yesterday, and it was just a mess with, I don't know what happened, if it was an emergency dig that they had to do at State and Randolph or what, but the traffic was just a mess, and so I ended up hiking from, Madison Street to Tribune Tower, but I have to tell you, with the weather this nice, it wasn't so bad. It was a good day for a good walk.
Yeah, right. That's just one of those things when we have this nice weather here, as you say, at last, we finally have a break in things. If you get detained or detoured by traffic or a lot of problems on a roadway, if you're able to walk and enjoy the weather, do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, Dave and Sam, I have to tell you, my mood was a lot better after Friday night. That Blackhawks win, I wasn't really bummed out after the first game overtime loss because fluke goals happened. And if you want to know about fluke goals, ask the Minnesota Wild. I don't know if anybody got to see. I actually, unfortunately, because we're in playoff hockey season, so it's like the TV's always on with a hockey game. And there was a Dallas Stars player behind the net that he's trying to score in. And the puck, literally, he tries to control the puck with his skate, but the skate flipped the puck onto the goalie's back, the Minnesota Wild goalie's back, and the goalie could feel it, and he's trying to back away from it, and the puck flies into the net. It was just, you talk about, if you thought that the Friday night, or the first game against the Blackhawks, that was a fluke goal off the skate, this was unbelievable. I know that the St. Louis fans are screaming about the outcome of Friday night's game and replays and all of that, but I was somewhat, I've never been a fan of Ken Hitchcock, the Blues coach. And to hear their coach complain that the Hawks are going to get all the calls because they're the defending champions just sounds like so much garbage to me.
I couldn't hear him over all the broken beer bottles that were flying on the ice in St. Louis. Can you believe that?
Yeah, I can, actually.
They went from singing Let It Be during the challenge, they were singing the Beatles' Let It Be, to throwing beer bottles in the matter of, 3 minutes?
Yeah. Well, and I have to tell you, so for those who don't know, the Blues scored a go-ahead goal, and it was very interesting because where I was watching the game, there was no sound, but there was a Blackhawks assistant coach was talking to Coach Q, and I could see him very clearly mouth the words offsides. And so when they did the replay, and you talk about a bang-bang millisecond play, and the Blues player's skate was clearly down and over the blue line before the puck entered. That's offsides in hockey. And at first I'm going, oh, that's a good goal, it's a good goal. Then when I saw the blue line camera, by milliseconds, guys offsides, there was no goal. And then the Hawks come with a Schauser right in the crease, getting the bounce and knocking it past Elliott, the goalie, and all of a sudden we got a Hawks win. And they had not played that great a game on Friday night. The first game they played a great game and lost in overtime on a fluke. But I'm really excited to have them back in town. And I got to tell you, I have to think. Though they have no problems on the road, coming home, I think, on this one with a game, with the teams pretty tightly matched, this is going to be a great game today.
And you're all ready, too. You're decked out. Whose sweater do you have on right now? It's a red one. I can't see the numbers, though.
No, I have the old CCM laced-up jersey, number 9.
Bobby Hull.
Bobby Hull.
Bobby Hull.
Bobby Hull.
I have one question.
Yes.
Now that we're into the playoffs here, is your superstition in place about not going to any of the games?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Wanted to clarify.
That is absolutely holding true.
Okay.
Because I don't want to go and be the – I don't want to be the goat.
Well, you can go to the goat down the street.
Well, there you go. Yes, exactly. But, no, my superstition still holds. And and anybody who knows me knows that when there's the Blackhawks playing playoff hockey, I am not a very good conversationalist.
No, I can attest to that.
Especially in the tie, like a tie game, third period.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And Sam, the conversation is between Rick and the TV. It's not with anybody that happens to be sitting next to.
No,
that's fair.
And in fact, Friday night at the place I was watching the game, I felt like I was like I said, they didn't have the sound on, so I was kind of informing the rest of the place what was going on with the game by my shouting at the TV. Things like no goal, no goal, you know, those kinds of things, and good goal. That's a good goal. It informed everybody else in the place when to applaud. So I'm doing my best for the Blackhawks. And, you know, of course, John and Troy have all the action right here on WGN AM 720 from the United Center. Game 3 of the first round Stanley Cup playoffs between our Blackhawks, the defending Stanley Cup champions, and that team from St. Louis, whatever they are, the Blues Who's, as I call them. But
the boo-hoos.
Yes, if you listen to Ken Hitchcock, their coach, they're the boo-hoos. And you know, maybe those calls that went against them got into their heads a little bit.
Couldn't get all the calls.
I, you know, as I said, I used to string Blues games.
When you were down
college,
there? Yes,
at the old Checker Dome. So I'm well familiar with the Blues' storied past, and if they exit in the first round, as we all expect that to take place, it'll be interesting to see if Mr. Hitchcock, you know, great name Hitchcock, why he ever became an NHL coach is a mystery to me. it'll be interesting to see if he has a job after this. So, pregame at 1:30 and the puck drop at 2 p.m. right here on Chicago's very own WGN AM 720. Well, Dave is here to keep us up on the news. Producer Jasmine is back this week and fielding your phone calls. She's at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. And as always on Twitter, @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is here to go through all the check marks and make sure that we'll be ready for the hockey game today. And as always, if you have to tune away, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. And you can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for me, Rick Pearson. We've got a great show coming up, but we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Come the Hawks, the Lightning, Blackhawks. Take the attack, yeah, and we'll back you, Blackhawks. You're flying high now, so let's wrap it up. Let's go, you Hawks, move on. Now all the Hawks, here come the Hawks.
Here come the Hawks.
You
might be hearing that bumper a little bit pretty often here on the show today because we're all excited about Game 3 of the Stanley Cup playoffs. But coming up, we've got a great show here today. Joining me after Dave's 7:30 news update is Democratic State Representative Robert Martwick of Chicago. We'll be talking about his bill to allow the state treasurer to audit life insurance companies and help reunite beneficiaries with their benefits. After the 8 o'clock news from Dave, my Tribune colleague Jeff Cohen joins the show. We'll be talking about his stories involving the task force recommendations on the Chicago Police Department, as well as his reporting on the sordid tale of former U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert. After the 8:30 news update, we'll be joined by Esther Corpus. She's the CEO of the Olivio Medical Center. And we'll also have Rebecca Shee in studio. Rebecca's executive director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. We'll be talking about healthcare legislation in Illinois and the overall issue of comprehensive immigration reform. That's all coming up, but first it's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and we've got a lot to talk about, including delegate awarding in several states on the Republican side. But first we're going to start with the Democrats, and all eyes are on New York, and it was in Brooklyn where Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders debated Thursday night. Here's some of the highlights.
Well, I think he hadn't done his homework, and he'd been talking for more than a year about doing things that he obviously hadn't really studied or understood, and that does raise a lot of questions. And really what it goes to is for voters to ask themselves, can he deliver what he's talking about? Can he really help people?
What do you
think? Can he help our economy? Can he keep our country strong? Well, obviously, I think I'm by far the better choice.
That was not from the debate. That was actually Hillary Clinton talking about the issue of the qualifications of Bernie Sanders, that being a bit of the debate. Bernie Sanders and Hillary, they've been basically going back and forth over New York, the issue of who is the bigger New Yorker. You've got a new Bernie Sanders ad that's out there that actually has him and Franklin Delano Roosevelt in it as a way to try to talk about when the chips are down and everything seems against the country. It takes a New Yorker to right the ship. So you've got that going on. You've got the fact of Hillary Clinton also with the new ad that's out there talking about Philadelphia, focusing on minority lives that ended abruptly. You've got issues like Joe Biden, who did an interview with an outfit called Mike, like the microphone, M-I-C. And he basically said, what he was asked, what would happen if a woman became elected president? And Biden said, well, I'd like to see a woman elected president. And the questioner went on to say, well, what about Hillary Clinton? And right then, Biden's staff breaks in to try to break up the interview. Goes, now wait a minute, I'm not going to go into the weeds here, but I think this country is ready for a woman president. And again, in that issue of qualifications and which candidate was more qualified, Biden says, they're both qualified, but he said that in his view, Hillary Clinton was overwhelmingly qualified to be president of the United States. So as I said, you've got that battle going on among the Democrats and Sanders trying to score an upset in a big state. Obviously, even where that upset to occur, the way the Democrats award their delegates is proportionately, like we do on the Democratic side here in Illinois. So a close finish would basically mean that both would still come out relatively equal in the delegates coming out of New York. But that having been said, Hillary Clinton still maintains a substantial lead in delegates, particularly off the strength of what are known as superdelegates. And those are those publicly party leaders and elected officials that have already pledged to support her in Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. So Sanders, has been doing well and has some momentum going, but his real work, and we always talk about how it comes down to the delegates, his real work will be to try to convince some of these superdelegates that may have already pledged to Hillary Clinton to take another look and try to come to his side. that's a very difficult road to go down. Now, when we go over to the Republican side, there were some delegate selection processes going on yesterday in Indiana, neighboring Indiana. Ohio Governor John Kasich actually emerged with a plurality of Republican delegates that were awarded at conventions in Indiana yesterday. So that does nothing to further Donald Trump's move forward. And also in Wyoming, 14 delegates up for grabs there, and it appears that that Texas Senator Ted Cruz has substantially picked up all 14 delegates there. West Virginia going through its kind of delegate selection exercise, which is a pretty cumbersome one, and I could spend the rest of the show trying to explain how they do the Republican delegates in West Virginia, and it's, you know, certainly designed that way. And of course, you've got Donald Trump out there complaining about, you know, he's millions of votes ahead, and he calls this a dirty system, and that they're changing the rules to try to deny him the nomination, which was kind of interesting because Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, resorted to going on Twitter, which is one of Donald Trump's favorite ways to communicate. Reince Priebus, the RNC chairman, goes on Twitter and says, "These rules have been in place for years. All the candidates know what the rules are." And his bottom line, without naming Donald Trump, was, quote, "Give us all a break," unquote. And so you also have Trump in the news, where he's not only campaigning in New York, but also in Pennsylvania, which has a trove of delegates up for selection. And at an appearance in Pittsburgh, Donald Trump said that he'd like to bring back Joe Paterno to Penn State. Apparently, Donald didn't realize that Joe Paterno is dead. You know, that nothing stops Trump. Nothing stops Trump at all. We talked about the delegate selection process. Obviously, a week ago was Colorado, where Trump got zilch. And there was even a video posted by a disgruntled Trump supporter in Colorado who showing him burning his Republican voter registration card in protest. So you've got that going on. You had Paul Ryan come out, give his Sherman-esque statement that if it's a brokered convention in Cleveland, he's not going to be the guy for the nomination. You've got John Kasich saying, "I'm still the best guy poised to be the nominee if there is a brokered convention." All of this playing out very much with the treasure trove of delegates of June 7th in California being the ultimate goal that probably will decide just how things are going to be in Cleveland in July. That's our spin through the national political news. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
312-981-7200 is our phone number on this bright and sunny Sunday morning on Michigan Avenue, here in the Allstate Showcase studio with the Sunday Spin. And joining me here in studio is State Representative Robert Martwick, Democrat from Chicago, who I know I'm interrupting your Sunday because you have Little League duties today.
I am marching in the Little League parade, yes.
And what better day?
Perfect.
You know, because
I can't tell you, I've been doing these forever, and you don't get many opening days like this.
Exactly. I mean, I was thinking of that Sox opener at home with the watching the snow and all of that.
Yeah,
and
I've seen it all.
It's amazing how the weather has finally kicked in just right. Well, Representative, thank you very much for joining me this morning. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on was this bill that you have. And this is kind of an initiative of Mike Frericks, the state treasurer. And it's an issue that has created some debate in Springfield. One of the duties of the state treasurer is to try to reclaim assets that haven't been attributed to people, you know, bank deposits, those kinds of things, unclaimed assets.
Right.
But this is kind of along those lines, but a different twist to it involving life insurance benefits. Explain what this legislation is.
Well, the way I usually describe it, which I always think is fun, is I say that this bill requires life insurance companies to locate and pay the proceeds of a life insurance policy to the beneficiaries. Well, to so which point most people go, aren't they supposed to do that already? Which, of course, I respond, not really. And so under the current law, a life insurance company is under no obligation to actually ascertain whether or not their policyholder has passed on. And in fact, some life insurance companies, it's their policy not to. And so what they do is that the law doesn't require them to look for a policyholder until the policyholder has reached the actuarial lifespan, which is roughly 104 years old. So let's just say, for instance, you're a low-level government worker. You fill out all your paperwork. You check this little checkbox on one of the forms for optional life insurance, and you die at 54. Well, if your loved ones, the ones you leave behind, don't know you had that policy and they don't actually approach the insurance company and provide the information, the insurance company, even you've stopped paying your policy, it's lapsed, they don't even look. They hang on to that. When you hit 104, then they'll start looking. And if they can find a beneficiary, if they can, if they can't, they give the money to the treasurer, which is how he gets involved in this. But even if they do find someone 50 years later, they're only required to pay the face value of the policy. They keep 50 years of interest accumulation. And some of these insurance companies have admitted, well, that's our business model. That's how we make our money.
It's cost of doing business for some of these insurance companies.
Yeah. So what this bill does is it requires insurance companies to do an annual check against a published list called the Social Security Death Master File, the DMF. And the DMF is Social Security saying, as far as we can tell, these are all the people around the country that have died. So they do a check once a year against this. And if they find anyone who has deceased, that is one of their policyholders, then they have to do a few things to try and contact beneficiaries, let them know so that those people can come forward and claim the proceeds of the policy.
What about in the case, as you described, where this could have been 50 years ago? How does that affect trying to do anything with the insurance companies there?
Well, it's same thing. They still have to try and find the beneficiaries now. If they can't find the beneficiary, now instead of waiting till 104 to turn over the money to the treasurer, they have to turn it over. I believe I'm going to forget the details of this, but I think it's 120 days after they ascertain that the person is dead and they've made their good faith efforts to locate him. So now instead of hanging on to that money and collecting the interest, it'll go to the treasurer, and then the treasurer will begin his efforts to find people who are entitled to this through
his unclaimed property and unclaimed asset.
That's right. Cash dash
kind of thing. The bill has passed the House?
It passed the House with 75 votes. I'm pleased to report I've passed something with bipartisan support. So 75 votes, which is a veto-proof majority. So we're all real happy about that, and we feel good about it going forward.
Who has the bill in the Senate?
Senator John Mulroe, who's my senator, has it in the Senate. There is a competing bill that's being carried by Senator Hain, and Senator Hain is the chairman of the Insurance Committee. His bill is a little bit more favorable to the insurance company. So we will see. Now we have these two competing bills in the Senate, and we'll see if there's some sort of reconciliation between the two.
Where is Senator Hain's bill? Where does it stand on the calendar?
Both of these bills are now in his committee. So he hasn't passed his bill out of the Senate yet. My understanding is they intend to have a subject matter hearing to talk about the pros and cons of both pieces of legislation and see where they go from there.
So, I mean, when I think of the insurance lobby in Illinois, it's a pretty powerful lobby.
No doubt.
Where are they dead set against this?
Yes. They're opposed, which is interesting because there are 22 life insurance companies that sell policies in Illinois that have already willingly adopted this practice. Because it's the right thing to do.
Just on their own.
Yeah. So when I talked about this bill on the floor of the House, I said this is not only a great bill in terms of consumer protection, but this really is a good business bill. Because what this does is it says 22 carriers are already willingly accepting this practice, and then there's a bunch that are fighting it. And what this does is this levels the playing field, so they're all competing on even terms. So it's good for the consumer, and it's good. It evens the playing field for businesses.
But on the but as far as the industry itself and its lobbying efforts, they're opposed to the bill because they don't want an additional regulation.
That's
I'm
correct.
Assuming, is
that
what
is
it
correct.
Down to.
Yep.
But still, 75 votes in the House.
Right.
Bipartisan support, which is something that is a rarity that you find in the Illinois General Assembly these days.
It is, but, you know, in the midst of this, at least I'm finding this has been great for me in my third year. I've passed four bills here already, and all of them have gone out with broad bipartisan support. This one, the least, at 75 votes. But if you continue to respect the people on the other side of the aisle, and continue to work in earnest on each individual issue and not hold the other stuff against them, we can still work together and get things done. So I hope that bleeds over to the budget discussions.
And kind of that's really what everybody is kind of hoping in using these, and I don't mean, I'm not, no disregard to this bill,
right,
but in using ancillary issues to try to find that elusive common ground that everybody talks about.
Right.
We're speaking with State Representative Robert Martwick, Democrat from Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Got the extended version of Chelsea Dagger going here in the Allstate Showcase studio. And here with Representative Robert Martwick, Democrat from Chicago, we're talking about his bill basically requiring the life insurance companies to pay the benefits that to survivors that in some cases they hold on to for years and years.
Yeah, and we talked about this being a consumer protection bill. It's so important. I mean, you think about it. Anyone who buys life insurance, their intention when they purchase it at that moment is that if something happens to me and I'm not around, I need some security for my loved ones. And the idea that there would be some intent on insurance companies to deny that from actually happening when you need it is just, I don't think anyone who buys life insurance at that moment think that's even a possibility.
Right. It's a benefit to be paid out. We've got a call from Darlene. Darlene, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Good morning. How do we get a list of the companies that do provide the information?
It's a good question. Yeah, it's a great question, Darlene. If I have it, if I would have thought you were going to ask that question, I would have brought the list with me. They are by and large the insurance companies that you might know, like Prudential, Mutual of Omaha, MetLife, New York Life, Transamerica. They're the bigger ones, and the brand names. It's some of the smaller ones. There is a lawsuit currently pending by Kemper, which is, they call themselves mom and pop. I don't know. They have their name on a building right down the street here. So I don't know how many mom and pops that own a skyscraper, but with $1.6 billion in assets. But there are some smaller ones that are fighting this. I'm sure the treasurer's website probably has a link.
I was going to say, or if you want to provide us with the list, we can put a link on our page.
I'll be happy to do that.
All right. Thank you, Darlene, for the call. Representative, I want to talk to you about a couple of other things going on in Springfield. It was kind of an interesting week last week. We had Speaker Madigan proposing a constitutional amendment to change the way, I think, really to allow for a lawsuit to challenge the way the state funds its public schools by kind of doctoring the wording from the primary responsibility, which has always been viewed as a goal by the Illinois Supreme Court, to basically a fundamental right, and that the state will pay the predominant share of the cost for public education. You attach that with the efforts to try to create a graduated income tax, and leader Liu Lang sponsored legislation for this, basically setting up what the tax rates would be if a constitutional amendment is adopted by the voters, passed by the legislature for a graduated income tax. First, I want to ask you about the issue of the school funding issue, because obviously, you know, when it comes to the schools and CPS and talk about taking all the oxygen out of the room, especially when you look at the fact that the teachers union has rejected that independent fact finding, and we're looking at the potential of a strike on May 16th.
Yeah.
What do you think about that constitutional amendment about the state being the primary share? Right now, I think it's the state picks up about 35 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, and so I agree with it. In 1996, when I ran unsuccessfully for the Senate, it was a big issue back then. It's been an ongoing issue. I think the vast majority of people in the state believe that is the responsibility of the state to fund education. We are dead last. We're last in the country in terms of state funding for education. And what a lot of people don't realize is people say we're a high-tax state. We're actually an extremely low-tax state from an income tax perspective.
From the state income tax, right.
The inability to raise money handcuffs our ability to fund our schools, which has led to one of three things. The wealthy areas, they raise the heck out of their property taxes to fund their education properly, and they scream about their high property taxes. The poor areas have no ability to do that, so they have lousy schools. And then you have the in-between situation. You have the area that could fund schools but chooses not to and bankrupts the system instead. Welcome to the city of Chicago.
And so you're supportive of the constitutional amendment, but that also would require, you know, there was a similar effort tried before, and I think that was in the 70s, in the 90s.
It was in the 90s. It was a big issue, yeah.
But, and then the number was $1.5 billion to $3 billion extra.
Right.
Where does that money come from?
Well, I think the reality, and again, Rick, I talk to people about the situation and the budget situation, as you can imagine, all the time. There are constantly advocates coming, and they come and they say, we're advocating for a solution to the budget crisis. And I say, stop asking for the end goal and start talking about the tools. The bottom line is, mathematically, there is no solution to our problems that doesn't include a tax increase. None. The governor himself admits it. How else do you propose a budget with $3.53 billion attributed to working together? Okay, so it's a blatant admittal that we need to raise revenue to close our budget gap. And, you know, if we do it properly, if we do it right, and we dedicate the revenues to the right places, if we're responsible for once, we could solve these problems. It's just difficult. Who wants to vote for a tax increase? Nobody wants to vote for a tax increase.
Particularly in an election year.
But, that's right.
But now what about Leader Lang's proposal about these graduated tax tax rates?
Yeah, I have been, from the inception of my involvement in politics, a proponent of a fair tax, which has lower rates on people who can less afford it, higher tax rates on people who can't afford it. So I'm happy that that's moving forward. The problem that I have at this point is that his rates, in my view, I'm just not sure that they make sense. They go from 3.5 to 3.75 to 8.75. I would rather see a smoother ramp that's fairer across the board. And what we need to do, really, again, simple answer, difficult decision. The simple answer is we're about $6 billion in the hole. The difficult answer is, how do you raise $6 billion? My understanding is that the analysis of this bill is that it provides $1.9 billion. Well, to me, that's like putting a Band-Aid on a severed artery. I think we're in a tough decision. We need to think bold, and we need to get it done right. I think the taxpayers expect that of us. I support Leader Lang's bill because it's a step in the right direction. I just hope that we can tweak it to actually close the gap. That's what people want.
So you'd like to see maybe perhaps more tiers.
Absolutely.
In this, based on income levels.
I have a proposal that would basically drop Wisconsin's income tax rates in. They would run from 4 to 7.65, so lower on that high end, just barely slightly higher on the bottom end, but even more even across the board. That would raise enough to close the budget gap, provide the funding for education that we're supposed to, help pay a $1 billion additional down on our pension debt and reinvest in some of the social service programs that we know pay dividends down the road. They save us more than they cost us.
What about kind of this restructuring of an income tax as some comprehensive tax issue where you look at a broadening of the sales tax and maybe a lowering of the rate, but broadening the application?
And at this point, I will tell you, I am open to any and all solutions. Leader Lang is one of the, you know, I think one of the most effective representatives down there, and he takes on the tough issues, so I'm not surprised he's doing this. As part of a comprehensive plan, that's fine. I just hope that we don't raise less than we need and kick the can down the road. That's the last thing the taxpayers want. So if it's part of broadening the sales taxes, I'll look at it. That's not my preference, to be honest with you. I think there's some need for it. But again, those generally tend to be more regressive than progressive. And, you know, we're the fifth most regressive tax state in the country. We tax the people who can least afford to pay it the most, more than all states except for four in the country. I think we need to be trying to balance that out so that we're making our tax system more fair.
That's Representative Robert Martwick, Democrat from Chicago. Representative, thank you so much for getting up with me this morning, and have a great time at the Little League Parade.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to my Tribune colleague, Jeff Cohen, about some of the investigative reporting he's done involving the Chicago Police Department, as well as former U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert.
Now, The Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson on this beautiful, sunny Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. And, you know, Dave, I heard your weather forecast, but I have to tell you, I'm looking at what Mike Hamernick has just posted after I was out on the WGN Storm Center patio. And Mike Hamernick has a high of 79 listed for today.
Well, we'll investigate that. I tell you what. Now, let's just jump ahead and take Mike's word for it.
50s near the lake, but a high of 79 today, and 80 tomorrow.
Let's go with Mike.
60s near the lake.
Let's go with Mike's forecast.
Yeah. No. I just want to give you an update here because
I'm glad you did.
That sounds tremendous.
And, it certainly does.
I think I need to have young Mr. Panayotovich come over, and hopefully he can show some of the talent that his father has on the grill and bring him over to the party patio for grilling today.
It's a very good idea.
How did he get you to say that he's got grill talent? That's what I want to know.
Okay, so what, he just hired it then all those years? You're gonna rat out the old man here
fair
on the radio
point, fair point.
Oh. Well, yeah, no, a beautiful couple of days ahead, according to our friends over at WGN Weather Center, 60s through the rest of the week starting on Tuesday, but then back into the 70s for next weekend. So
yeah, that's exactly right. Day like today for next Saturday.
We're starting to get into that nice schedule where we get the weather on the weekends the way it's supposed to be.
That's right.
But nevertheless, it's still hockey weather here in Chicago.
It'll be 32 in 2 weeks. We all know it. We'll be shoveling again.
I've seen snow in May here.
I think, Dave, you might be able to put away the newsroom Zamboni. It might be time.
Oh, I finally got it started.
Yeah, figures. Yeah, doesn't it?
I finally got it started.
No, you lost the key last week.
It's not a pole start?
No, it's a key.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, gosh. Well, get out there. Enjoy this beautiful weekend weather. It's just gorgeous out there today. Joining me now is my good friend and Tribune colleague, Jeff Cohen, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. And Jeff really has done yeoman's work the last couple of days on a variety of stories. And obviously, one I want to get to off the top is the issue of the Chicago Police Department and the independent task force that reviewed what was going on in the police department, kind of an effort, I think, to try to jump ahead of whatever the U.S. Department of Justice does in its investigation of the police department. Jeff, welcome to the show.
How you doing, Rick?
I'm doing very well, thank you. this, you know, in some respects, when you look back at what Mayor Emanuel has said following the release of this full report, that in his words, like, well, this isn't necessarily telling us stuff we didn't already know.
Yeah, I would say that's true, although I don't think that he has not really made in-depth public comments yet about the material that's in this report. But I think that, you know, part of what was interesting to, you know, political observers in town is that initially this task force was sort of criticized, and I'm sure you remember it was even protested by some of the protesters that have been all over town in the wake of the Laquan McDonald shooting. But, you know, there was some concern that it was, first of all, it was the mayor's task force. There were questions about Lori Lightfoot, who was put in place to head it. You know, she was general counsel at OPS, which is the agency that preceded IPRA. So there were questions and concerns about just how independent it might be. Hiram Grau was on the task force. He's a former CPD leader. So people were sort of expecting that this might just be, you know, sort of a puppet exercise. But what we saw was this task force, you know, really did take a quality swing at what's going on at CPD, and it's kind of left the mayor in a bit of a spot between dealing with his police department and this task force that has now, you know, really been critical.
Yeah, I mean, as you pointed out with the idea of the protest, that this was going to be, you know, kind of viewed as whitewashing the department and that kind of thing, where it really was a big swing, you know, when you come out and basically, as a task force, say that the police department must acknowledge a history of racism and overhaul the way it handles excessive force allegations, and the whole idea of a lack of trust, which is something that people have talked about, but now you have it kind of formalized in this document.
Yeah, well, it really was. And I mean, if you remember when the mayor announced the task force, he said that one of the jobs would be to, you know, take a look at IPRA, see if there are any recommendations that could be made to improve the way they do investigations. And the task force came back and basically said, yeah, blow it up. I mean, that was their recommendations, to get rid of it and replace it. And you're right, they really criticized the department for having systemic racism. And I think that they were really struck by some of the community forums that they held. They had four of those where they heard from people in the community who, you know, I think it went beyond just complaints about police tactics to really feeling completely disrespected. And the task force turned that into, you know, in their report saying that they felt that the police were really criminalizing entire neighborhoods, where almost every interaction with people in these neighborhoods, you know, not to put a complete blanket on there, because obviously there are, I'm sure, police officers who do well, but by and large, people are complaining that, pardon me, even the most upstanding members of their community were being approached as if they must be doing something wrong on the street, and every single traffic stop and whatever else was coming from the view of, well, there must be something else major going on because I have a person of color here that I'm dealing with. And so I think the task force really wanted to chop away at that completely, have CPD kind of hit the reset button, have the superintendent kind of go around on an apology tour, have everybody acknowledge that there's a systemic problem, and kind of rebuild it from there. You know, build up community trust. One of the things they called for is having caps replaced also by something at the district level, where commanders actually work with what they call community stakeholders, you know, leaders in these communities, and kind of have a working relationship where, coming in the door, CPD isn't treating everybody like, you know, a criminal in waiting.
We're speaking with Jeff Cohen, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. This is the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and joining me on the phone is my friend and Tribune colleague, Jeff Cohen. He's an investigative reporter at the Tribune. We're talking about the task force that was formed after the Laquan McDonald shooting video controversy, and Jeff's look into what this task force had reported. And Jeff, one thing I thought was interesting was the idea of just abolishing the Independent Police Review Authority, which is something that, for the most part, the mayor has stood behind.
Yeah, he had stood behind it, at least up until relatively recently when he asked for the resignation of the head of it. But, yeah, even in announcing his task force, he made it sound like it was something that could be reformed or changed or do its job better. We're not sure how surprised he was by the recommendation that it go away and be replaced by something that's a little bit more community-based. But it's something he's going to have to deal with now. And some of these changes that the task force is recommending would actually take some changes in state law, related to collective bargaining with the police department. But they really do want a complete redo and a lot more transparency and things that, we all sometimes get some pushback from the mayor's office. So we'll see how it goes.
And that was another thing, too, is it never entered my mind that the collective bargaining agreement with the police was part of what the task force basically said was institutionalizing a code of silence.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting as well. And if you think about it, if you were to handle, say a criminal investigation, not to, criminalize the police department, but if you were to do that, you wouldn't let witnesses take 24 hours to get their story straight. You wouldn't necessarily let witnesses talk to each other. You wouldn't confront a witness with video evidence and then expect or allow them to change their testimony or change their story. But that's essentially what's built into the collective bargaining with the police department. And the task force came back and said this is overly protective. In addition to all those things, if you're trying to make a complaint, you can't really do so anonymously, or at least when it comes down to having somebody actually investigate it, you have to have a written affidavit. So you have to have people take this extra sworn step, and the task force point, I think, was that you need to be able to have the main goal be to investigate police behavior, and sometimes that might take an anonymous complaint. I mean, think of all the anonymous complaints that we've dealt with in the news business that have turned into who knows what. But to have that built into the collective bargaining process and have that built into the contracts, they really saw that, as you said, sort of codifying at least the ability to maintain a code of silence, and you really can't run it that way if you want independence and you want to get the result you're looking for all the time.
Speaking about the collective bargaining agreement in the police union, we've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning, Rick, and to your guests. I think what's more alarming, even than what came out of the report, was the response from Mr. Angelo from the FOP. If you're going to deny all of these, allegations, then how are you going to get any kind of reform? And my second question is, how can there be any credibility with the new, interim superintendent when he has come from the same police department where these things have taken place? And I think he gave a statement like he has never seen it or heard it. So what credibility does he have? So thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Ron. Jeff?
Yeah, thanks for the call. I think that you do set up some interesting questions there, and I do think the FOP response was telling as well, at least in the way that there was some pushback there. Obviously, they have their own interest to protect. I thought it was interesting, too, that in part of the response was them pointing out that this could be another morale hit for the department as well. That's what I was mentioning earlier, is the mayor's already dealing with a spike in homicides, and the crime rate has gone up, and the FOP is suggesting this could be another blow to that. But it remains to be seen, I think. The new superintendent, Eddie Johnson, he hasn't said too much on this report. I mean, if people were paying attention last week, you saw him questioned initially, and he said, well, essentially I need to review this, and he's open to at least some of the changes. He's talked about being open to more oversight, at least. What that looks like, we'll see. But again, it's sort of early in the process here. We're not sure how surprised the mayor was and how surprised the new superintendent was that they're going to have to deal with a task force set of recommendations of this magnitude, so to speak. And they're going to kind of have to either implement many of them, or it sets up a fallback position of where it looks like, they maybe didn't do enough. If we have another problem in the future and it comes down on the side of something that might have been prevented by this task force recommendations, then you've kind of started the problem all over again. So if there was ever a chance for the mayor to want and the new superintendent to want to kind of completely start this over and do it in a way that
you know, might be better for everybody, and have the cover of a task force that the mayor appointed, you know, making that recommendation, then this might be that time. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, and I do think Ron's call does go kind of that to that split that exists with the appointment of Eddie Johnson about one, you know, in the neighborhoods where he has worked, for the most part, the community activists and advocates in those neighborhoods were very supportive of his activity in working in those neighborhoods. But at the same time, he is of this institution that is tremendously under fire. And, you know, how can he affect change? And that seems to be the kind of the great coin flip question.
Yeah, well, I you know, what you just set up, that dichotomy he has, I really doubt that was an accident. I mean, he kind of had to make a play for somebody with a foot in both of those worlds. If you think about it, if you had to make the pick, if you bring in somebody who's completely from the outside and the true reformer is going to come in, you know, knocking the tables over in there, you're going to have a police revolt. And if you, you know, do the other side, you're going to have problems the other way. So he kind of needed somebody who was acceptable to the community and also had a history with CPD. They feel like, you know, he's sort of one of their own as well. He kind of had to strike a little bit of balance. But you're also correct that now it's sort of crunch time. He's going to have to deal with the real problems. And I think it was even clear at the city council meeting the other day, you know, there basically is no honeymoon period here. He's got to come in the door and do the job and make some major fixes.
I want to switch gears on you real quick in a few minutes we have left with you to talk about the other major story that you worked on involving former U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert. And,
sure.
Which you could, if you read between the lines, you could tell that this took a tremendous amount of legwork and talking to these people who alleged victims of Hastert. And it still is stunning to me that that this is coming out so many decades later after his tenure as a wrestling coach at Yorkville High School.
Yeah, it's really, you know, obviously a tragic and sad but interesting case. And, yeah, you're correct. It took us quite a while to kind of wade through the large group of students that he would have had contact with back then to try to figure out if we could, you know, tell part of this story ahead of time. And it was me and really and Christy Gutowski, another reporter at the paper, I know that you know well, who did a lot of the work to try to locate some of these men. And it's really has set up sort of a sad tale of a major politician in his career. Excuse me, Rick. Coming apart really at the end of his career. And it sets up a really interesting sentencing hearing, I think, on the 27th. I don't know how closely you followed some of the issues that have circulated more recently, but I think we're going to have a real sentencing hearing when it's going to be major argument over how much time he spends behind bars, if any. Well, and I can talk a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, well, certainly the issue of making a false statement to federal agents, which was not part of the prosecutorial effort here, but certainly seems like something right. That the judge definitely wants considered.
Yeah, the issue, I don't think it's not unexpected that Hastert's lawyers would come in and say, you know, he pleaded guilty to structuring. He's trying to avoid, you know, federal requirements on reporting of cash withdrawals, which he used, you know, for these past. But they said basically that's the crime here. That's what he pleaded guilty to. And they're trying as much as they can to keep the judge concentrated on that. You know, the guideline sentence for that is 0 to 6 months. So they've asked for probation because of his health and a variety of other reasons. Prosecution is trying to put forward, you know, the actual information on some of the alleged victims. They're going to bring in an actual victim who's going to testify about, you know, allegedly being abused by Hastert in the 70s. And I think that's why the judge concentrated on part of the story the other day in their last hearing. If you remember, individual A, who has stayed quiet and is not expected to testify, apparently when federal agents confronted him about Hastert payments, Hastert had told the feds basically that he was being falsely extorted. So the judge kind of seized on that and said, you're trying to get me to concentrate on alleged acts from decades ago. But this just happened a year ago when he was finally confronted. Hastert basically tried to put a fake extortion rap on this guy. And he said he's going to take that into account in sentencing. So I think we're going to have some interesting you know, exchanges in that room that day where we're going to see what the future holds for Mr. Hastert, but it should be interesting.
That's Jeff Cohen, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune, my good friend and Tribune colleague. Jeff, thanks very much for getting up with me this morning.
Thanks, Rick. No problem. See ya.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, Esther Korpas, CEO of Alivio Medical Center, and Rebecca Shee, Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin on this beautiful Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. I'm joined by Esther Korpas, CEO of Alivio Medical Center, and Rebecca Shee. She's the executive director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. And I wanted to have them both in to talk about some legislation, recent legislation that passed the House. As we talked to Representative Martwick earlier, a bipartisan supported a piece of legislation about continuing covering all kids. And Esther, I want you to talk about this because this was a pretty dynamic statement when you look at how stalemate the legislature is for their endorsement of this legislation. What is it? How does it work?
Okay, thank you, Rick, for having me. All Kids is the state-funded program that provides health care benefits to about 41,000 children in the state of Illinois. And it's been in existence for 11 years. It had bipartisan support 11 years ago. And we're simply asking the legislature to extend the sunset, which is due to sunset June 30th of this year. And we're asking that it makes no sense from a public health perspective to cut those benefits. We also get a federal match. So this is a program that provides so much good for kids at a very low cost.
And this provides coverage regardless of immigration status.
Absolutely. There's about 1,000 kids that are undocumented that do receive coverage. And I can tell you firsthand, at Alivio Medical Center, about 40% of our patients are undocumented. And so for me, at my health center, not to have coverage for our children would be devastating.
Now, that coverage for undocumented is not federal reimbursed, is it?
Well, they are covered.
They're covered by the state.
They are, but we don't get the federal match for those individuals.
Right, because I know that had been an issue when the program was first proposed, was in, you know, what kind of a financial responsibility is the state undertaking here.
Right.
But the bottom line, and from its initial passage to its continuance, is that it's a declaration of policy of the state of Illinois, and certainly I would imagine it's so much like we talk about health care issues, that preventative or front-end health care basically saves so much money on the back end.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for children, when they're healthy, we know that they do better in school. They're happier in their home situation. But it also covers a lot of our complex patients who have, you know, severe medical issues, and it would be devastating for them not to have this kind of coverage.
Now, in light of the state's budget problems, its impasse that has left us 10 months without a state budget, where exactly, I mean, this is a declaration of policy, but how does that impact, for example, your medical center and kind of reimbursement? Is there federal pass-through money that's moving, but mm-hmm. the state share is not there? How does that work?
Well, we have consent decree, so we did go to court with the Shriver Center back over the summer, luckily, we are getting reimbursed for our Medicaid programs, but it's still difficult because the payment cycle is still somewhat slow. And so, you know, having to really manage our cash flow has been a challenge for healthcare centers, but, you know, as you know, other community-based organizations.
So when you're down there, and you were just down in Springfield.
And we'll be back on Tuesday.
And we'll be back on, I mean, what do legislators tell you about trying to get out of this impasse?
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of hope in resolving a lot of their issues that are preventing us from having a budget. So I can't imagine that we would go into a second year in this same situation, but it doesn't sound like there's a lot being resolved, unfortunately.
You can't believe we're going to go into a second year?
Well, I don't want to believe that we're going to do this again.
I was just going to say, because I don't know, you know, what is going to be the trigger. And all along, just like you have, trying to, you see these triggers that you think are going to make people move, and it doesn't happen.
That's right.
So as far as the covering all kids, obviously the bill moves to the Senate. What kind of reception does the legislation have there?
I think that it's always a lot more comfortable on the Senate side, but the bill is actually being called on Monday, so it hasn't moved through the House yet.
Okay.
So that will happen on Monday. We do have bipartisan support. We hope that they're all there on Monday to vote on it. But we feel comfortable, but we're not taking anything for granted that this bill is an important one, and we need everyone to support it.
What have you heard from the governor's office on this legislation?
Well, Director Felicia Norwood, who is the director of Health and Family Services, is supporting it. So I'm, hopeful that the governor is in support of it as well, since she does represent the governor on health care.
Represents healthcare. The administration,
right,
on
that's
that
correct.
Point. But it got out of committee 15 to 2. I didn't mean to short you four votes there.
with actually four Republicans, including the Deputy Minority Leader Patty Bellock, supporting it. And so we're hopeful, like Esther said, that this will pass in the House with strong bipartisanship, also because I think that the committee vote demonstrated both Democrats and Republican leadership supports this, but also the fact that this bill was a standalone bill that got pulled out of the larger, say, Medicaid budget or the state budget showed that that they don't want this to be lost in the bigger political fight, right? That both the governor and Speaker Madigan cares about these vulnerable children, and that, this was a bipartisan decision made 11 years ago that all children should be treated equally and that all children should have access to affordable care.
And that also that this, as you said, separated out of the bigger fight,
right,
and also not use people to be held hostage as part of the bigger fight as well, not having kids in need of medical care being held hostage in the bigger scope of things.
Absolutely.
When you look at, and people have been throwing that word hostage around throughout this whole budget impasse. We're speaking to Esther Korpas, CEO of Alivio Medical Center, and Rebecca Shee from the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Come the Hawks. Game 3. Pregame at 1:30 here on your sports station for all Blackhawks games. WGN Radio 720. 1:30 pregame, 2 o'clock. Puck drop at the United Center. Game 3. The Hawks are at home. Series tied 1-1 against some team from St. Louis. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase studio, which unfortunately is in blue. We need to paint that red, I think. But we've got Esther Korpas. She's CEO of the Alivio Medical Center, and Rebecca Shee, Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. And I know that, Esther, you wanted to talk about the Healthy Illinois program that's going on. What is that?
So Healthy Illinois is a group of individuals that have come together, both healthcare entities, faith-based organizations, other community organizations that are working together to ensure that all Illinoisans have health care. But this year we have made extending the sunset for the Healthy Kids program a priority for us. And so that's why we've been.
So this is kind of the coalition for the for healthy kids, for all kids, that extending that coverage for everybody.
And eventually, hopefully, adults as well.
Steps, steps, steps.
Yes.
Right, right, absolutely. Right. Rebecca, I wanted to talk to you about the whole issue of comprehensive immigration reform. And because we talked about this, you were part of the panel that I moderated out at Aurora University. And, you know, I kind of viewed that panel as trying to clear up some of the myths that exist when it comes to immigration. And now, granted, in a tough political year, immigration, comprehensive immigration reform is not likely to be seen anywhere. No one is talking about it. But it's still something that your group right. wants to see done. And, you know, let's one of the issues is you, and I get asked about this too, is like, well, you know, how does having undocumented people, don't they just take the jobs of people at in this time of economic uncertainty that can't get jobs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Rick. And that was a beautifully moderated panel that you did at Aurora. Yeah, that's one of the myths that our employers at the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition works to debunk all the time. Undocumented immigrants, they work, they are job creators, and they're taxpayers. So in Illinois, for example, undocumented immigrants pay annually over $570 million to our state tax base, from which they are ineligible to get any sort of benefit, right, because they don't have a Social Security number. And in addition to that, they work in jobs that native-born do not want to work in. So one of our most prominent members is the Illinois Restaurant Association, and the employers there always talk about that undocumented immigrants, they work at the back of the house, for example, as dishwashers, busboys, and a lot of native-born, they like to be waitresses, they like to be hostesses. And so what immigrants do is that they complement the jobs that native-born would rather work in, and they make it so that there are more jobs created at the front of the house, right? So that's one example. The other example is, you know, agriculture, right? The Farm Bureau and peach growers, pig farmers are an important part of my coalition as well. And they talk about year after year just the difficulty of navigating the lower skill visa program, the H-2 program, and that they would rather be able to hire legal workforce. But, you know, the native born, the kids have left the town. A lot of these rural areas are moving to big cities for schools or jobs. And so the only workforce that's accessible to them are undocumented immigrants, right? And they pay very well. But our system is so broken that our employers want to hire a legal workforce, but they cannot because the system hasn't been fixed in the last 30 years. And so as the business coalition, we've been pushing very hard, you know, as the business voice inside of this immigration debate to say that if you believe in a stronger economy, if you want to see creating more jobs for Americans, then we need a common sense immigration solution that is, you know, similar to what Speaker Paul Ryan has already put forth, that's similar to what, you know, the Senate passed several years ago, that expands high-skill, low-skill visas and creates a path to legal status or citizenship for those that are here who are undocumented.
But you're not hearing anything on the federal level of any steps moving forward with this anytime soon.
Right. Not this year, not currently, though I do want to say you do hear about immigration every day right now during this very heated debate, but not good. But I think what's really interesting is that I think this fall's election will be a referendum on immigration issues, right, unless something, I think, extraordinary happens, right? Because you have one side on the GOP, a very harshly anti-immigrant candidate, whether it's Trump or Cruz, and then you have on the other side with the Democrats a much more inclusive candidate. And so What's really exciting, I think, that's happening is that you see states like Illinois, Colorado, Florida, and Nevada, where immigrants are actually mobilizing like never before to become citizens and to vote, right? So if you look at the day that Trump announced his presidency, and he called Mexicans rapists and criminals, to January of this year, there was a jump of 14% in the rate of immigrants becoming citizens. And we know that naturalized citizens vote at a much higher rate than native-born and even millennial. And so, you know, in a democracy, the voter ultimately decide. And so I think at this moment, it's very interesting to see, you know, Republicans at the statewide level claiming different voices and sending messages that there are different voices in the Republican Party on issues like immigration. So,
did it take something like Trump's pronouncement, you think, to mobilize that voter registration that traditionally wasn't there? Because, you know, when you look at the Republican Party and they did that famed autopsy after Mitt Romney lost, and one of the things was about growing the party, and growing the party was reaching out to the immigrant community to, you know, grow the party. And Trump just kind of threw that right back, you know, back in the Republican leaders' faces.
Right, right. No, that's exactly it. And I think, you know, Mitt Romney got, 27% of the Latino vote and even less of the Asian vote. But the rhetoric that we're hearing from Trump and Cruz are much more severe, right, than what Mitt Romney said. And so I think you're absolutely seeing the connection between legal immigrants that have probably waited years and years, right, to naturalize and haven't done so, coming to workshops, coming to, bring their whole family to apply for citizenship so that they can vote in November. And we're seeing this across the country. So,
Rebecca Shee, Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. Esther Corpus, CEO of Alivio Medical Center. Thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this special Blackhawks Sunday Spin edition. I want to thank my guests, Representative Robert Martwick, Democrat from Chicago, Jeff Cohen, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune, Esther Corpus, CEO of Alivio Medical Center, and Rebecca Shee from the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening on this bright and sunny Sunday.